everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Yeah, we got a good show today. I just can't wait to get into it. I'm feeling really good right now. You know, I always like to talk about the weather. And here in New York City, it's summertime, and it's been kind of hot and unpleasant. But today, we had a little rain in the morning. And for those of you out in drought lands, you know, I don't want to rub it in that we have some water here. But we did have a little rain. And what's especially lovely about the rain for me is I live next to a park. And the park, about 10 years ago, was a really nice place. But somehow it's changed over the last few years where we have a lot more screaming of all ages. And it doesn't sound as a happy place, but maybe it is. Maybe I'm just misinterpreting the noises. But when it rains, it's quiet. And I've really been enjoying a nice day today with a little peace and quiet. But now it's dried up a little bit, so maybe the screaming will start again real soon. Okay, I want to bring on my first guest. I'm so excited to talk about what we're going to be talking about. This is really incredible news that we all need to be discussing and sharing. Matthew Liebman is senior attorney in the litigation program at the Animal League Defense Fund. And he is involved in all aspects of the ALDF civil cases, including investigating reports of animal cruelty, conducting legal research, developing new legal theories, and appearing in court. He has litigated cases including ALDF versus Conyers, which resulted in the rescue of more than 100 dogs from a North Carolina hoarder, and another case in which 7 horses were saved from starvation, Animal Place versus Chung, which seeks justice for 50,000 hens abandoned without food by egg farmers. Matthew's writing has appeared in the Animal Law Review, the Journal of Animal Law, the Stanford Environmental Law Journal, and the Animal Legal and Historical Web Center. With Bruce Wagman, Matthew co-authored A Worldview of Animal Law, which examines how the legal systems of different countries govern our interaction with animals. So much more about Matthew. You can read that at my site, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Meanwhile, welcome to It's All About Food, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. I know you've been really busy, especially with this recent ruling in Idaho, which I want to talk quite a bit about. So before we get started, I want to give you a big round of applause, you and your entire team, for
thank
doing
you very much. Yeah,
incredible
definitely
work.
A team effort.
Is really important, and I hope you've taken the time to just like take it all in and celebrate for a moment.
We have, yes.
Oh, good. Because sometimes, you know, when we're involved in some things, it just gets so crazy that there is never really a moment to take it all in and enjoy what you've accomplished. And we need to do that for our own sanity.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And animal law is definitely a challenging field, and to have big wins like this can seem rare,
okay.
but happy when they happen.
Before we get to the big win of last week, I want to talk about these ag-gag laws and how our wonderful justice system possibly could have approved this type of legislation. Can you give me a little history?
Sure. So ag-gag laws are essentially make it a crime to conduct an undercover investigation at an agricultural facility, which is typically read to mean a factory farm or a slaughterhouse. And these are basically an industry-coordinated response to a recent trend over the last decade or so. There have been maybe 100 undercover investigations at factory farms and slaughterhouses, and every single one of them has revealed horrific animal suffering, and that can be anything from malicious and sadistic cruelty, like workers punching or kicking animals for no reason, but also things that are common and prevalent throughout the industry, like intensive confinement of hens in battery cages or of pregnant sows in tiny gestation crates. And obviously, when these investigations come out, they reveal things that the industry would much rather keep hidden from the public. And so their coordinated response has been to approach state legislators and have them introduce these ag-gag bills, which essentially, rather than going after, trying to find a way to stop the animal cruelty, to instead shut up the activists and put them in prison for trying to show the American public what really happens on these farms.
I guess I don't understand how those things get passed.
Yeah.
We're all about freedom of speech, and I don't know, we seem to have a romance with whistleblowers in this country. It's hard to believe, but it happens that these things get passed.
Yeah, there are 8 states that have passed ag gag laws, and these are, not surprisingly, mostly heavily agricultural states, ones with a very effective ag lobby that spends a lot of money lobbying politicians. And so I guess we shouldn't be too surprised when pro-industry bills get introduced.
Okay, so you went to Idaho and filed a complaint and won.
That's right. Yeah, last Monday we finally got a decision. This case was filed last year, essentially challenging their ag gag law under various provisions of the Constitution. We just got a decision on Monday, last Monday, ruling in our favor.
Now, I don't watch a lot of television, but occasionally I watch these programs that show different court proceedings with lawyers, and they're very dramatic, and things happen at the last minute, and people are running around trying to find information. Was this anything like what we see on television?
Last Monday wasn't. That was, I was just in my office and got word that the court had issued its opinion. So, the kind of drama we see on TV is obviously fictionalized and a bit more condensed than how it happens. But that's not to say this case hasn't been interesting to litigate. We've had certainly been in court in Boise on a couple of occasions arguing our case to the judge in fairly packed rooms with very interested reporters and members of other public interest groups and farmers, and even the legislators that introduced these bills were coming to the hearings to see how see what was going to happen to their law. So there were moments of excitement and interest, but last Monday was we just got word that the judge had issued his opinion, and we're reading it on our computers like everybody else.
I read the opinion. It's pretty amazing. Did you have any idea during the proceedings that it was going to go this way?
We were optimistic. I think our intuitions were similar to yours, that there's just no way that a bill or a law that's prime intent was to silence half of a debate on a significant public issue could possibly pass constitutional muster. And there was an earlier stage in the litigation, what's called a motion to dismiss, where the state had tried to have our lawsuit dismissed on various procedural and legal grounds. And the ruling on the motion to dismiss strongly suggested that the judge was seeing things our way, but that was a preliminary motion, and so he didn't rule in our favor at that point. But we had suggestions that he saw this law as violating the Constitution in the same way we did. So we filed what's called a motion for summary judgment, which the judge granted, and that's the decision that you have.
Now, is this going to stick, or do you think, will there be any appealing? Can that be done at this level?
It can be done. We don't have any indication one way or another whether the state's going to appeal. I know that the ag lobby in Idaho is strong pushing the Attorney General to appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And if that happens, we're certainly ready and willing to go the distance. We think that judges on the Ninth Circuit will see things the way Judge Windmill did in this case and agree that this statute violates both the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution.
Well, anybody who's not familiar with any of this, if you just know that these facilities where they're raising animals are closed to anyone, some of these are just like these giant warehouses with no windows in some cases. You can't see anything. And you wonder why that is. It's because nobody wants to see what's inside, even the workers that are inside. Not just the non-human animals, but the human animals are treated horribly as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's why these ag gag laws have brought together a pretty wide-ranging coalition of public interest organizations. I mean, our lawsuit was not just the Animal Legal Defense Fund and other animal rights groups. You know, we had People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and Farm Sanctuary, but we also had groups like the ACLU of Idaho. We had environmental organizations like Western Watersheds Project and a lot of other groups from different communities. You know, journalists were outraged about this statute, and farm worker protection groups were outraged as well. As you say, you know, these are low-paid workers that are often treated horribly, and if one of them, you know, wants to pull out their cell phone and take video of the horrible working conditions they're subjected to, they shouldn't go to prison for doing so.
Exactly. Now, one of the things I loved in the declaration or in the ruling was a reference to the author Upton Sinclair and his book, The Jungle, which came out in the early 20th century. And because of that fictional book, which was based on a lot of horrible things that were actually going on in meatpacking plants in Chicago, we got the Pure Food and Drug Act and Federal Meat Inspection Act. We got good legislation that improved our food system, and it pointed out that Upton Sinclair, had he been around today with ag gag laws, could have been criminalized.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was a good point that the judge made in his decision. And, you know, one of the things that ag gag laws criminalize are gaining access to a facility by misrepresentation. And a lot of the ways undercover investigations take place is someone will go and apply for a job, but not disclose that they're affiliated with an animal rights organization or not disclose that they're a journalist. And they go and they do the job. They're not sort of slacking or depriving the owner of the farm of anything. They're not stealing, but they, in the course of doing their job, document things and ask questions. And that's how these investigations take place. And if you make it a crime to lie on an employment application, then you're essentially shutting down these investigations. And that's how Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle. You know, he went in as an employee without disclosing who he was or what his intentions were.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we all reap the benefits of his having done that through, you know, landmark federal legislation that has been crucial to food safety.
Okay, so I'm going to turn the subject around a little bit. This is kind of related. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but I'm just wondering how you feel about what's been going on with Planned Parenthood recently, because there were some undercover videos and now they're turning against Planned Parenthood. And there was even a Los Angeles court that was banning future videos until further notice coming out from this particular group that was doing undercover work. Now, I'm on the left side in general in my politics, and I believe Planned Parenthood is doing good work. So I wasn't really happy when these videos came out, even though I know they've been edited and misconstrued, whatever. But do they have that right to do that under the Constitution with free speech?
I can't say. I don't know the facts well enough to say whether or not they had a right to do that. I mean, I will say that, you know, if we have a commitment to the values of the First Amendment, that should apply regardless of what the subject matter is. And so I'm also on the left, but, you know, I don't think judges should be prohibiting the release of information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Judge Windmill makes the point in this ag gag decision that the solution to speech you don't like is more speech. And I think Planned Parenthood has every right to come out and say, you know, these conversations are taken out of context. Here's, you know, what this conversation was really about. And, you know, in a democratic society, having that conversation is significant. And the cure for speech you don't like is more speech. And so, I would not support sort of preemptive bans on the release of information. I think the better solution is for people to have a conversation about what's wrong with those videos if they're misleadingly edited, or, you know, to try to give more context about what's been left out of the videos. And certainly you know, the meat industry is welcome to do that if they want to look at these videos and say, you know, these practices are defensible for these reasons. They're welcome to do that, and we'll have an open public debate about it. But we can't have
and we'll
that
let
debate
people
if,
come into our facilities and see for themselves, right?
Yeah,
that's what they should be doing. Ha ha.
Right.
Yeah, we know what we'd find, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now you said there were 8 states, so I imagine you're going to be on the path attacking another state pretty soon, if not already.
Yeah, we already have a case going in Utah challenging their ag gag statute. So, you know, that case is moving forward. It's unclear what's going to happen in Idaho if there's an appeal. Obviously, we'll have to spend resources on that. So I don't know whether we're going to be, you know, going after another state in the near future. It's certainly a possibility, and those other 6 states that we haven't sued yet are definitely ones that we're scrutinizing and trying to figure out what our next best step is. But I would say that none of them are exempt from constitutional scrutiny.
And are you involved at all, or do you have an opinion on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act? That's another goodie that's been out and about for a number of years.
Yeah, that's a you know, one of these statutes that was passed, essentially turning some forms of activism, even you know, some forms of what we think of as traditional protest activity, lumping them under the umbrella of terrorism, and I think that's extremely problematic. You know, these ag gag laws go much further than the AETA does, but you know, AETA is something that the Animal Legal Defense Fund opposed when it was a bill, and it's, you know, we were disappointed to see that the constitutional challenges to that statute so far haven't succeeded.
Yes, well, I mean, the idea of labeling someone a terrorist who's trying to fight the terrorism is a scary thing. I don't support any kind of violence, and I know that that's how that act came about or was strengthened, because of some violent acts that unfortunately shouldn't have happened. Nobody was hurt, but a lot of people got scared. And I like going the route that you're doing, fighting with the law and bringing sense and clarity until people get it. Okay, everybody. Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. We had a little brief interruption there and a little technological glitch. Maybe it's the rain. I'm not sure what it is, but we're back. And Matthew, you're back.
Yes, sorry about that.
Okay. Oh, no problem. I'm glad everything's okay. So what I wanted to know is how a nice guy like you ended up in a place like the Animal League Defense Fund, which is great, but I mean, we need more great attorneys fighting the fight for the voiceless. And what inspired you to do that?
Well, my journey to animal rights started when I was a teenager. I had a pet bird who I was told I should just feed him whatever I was eating, in addition to his regular pellets and fruit and vegetables. And I was eating chicken one day and went to give him some, and sort of had this weird realization that the chicken, that it seemed kind of cannibalistic, and then it sort of dawned on me that if this chicken was so close to him that he shouldn't eat it, that maybe I shouldn't eat it either, given the strong bond and friendship that we had. And that sort of opened my eyes to the, you know, obvious reality that meat comes from animals, and I went vegetarian shortly after that. In college, I was a philosophy major, and in a first-year philosophy class, read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, and that helped crystallize things and started getting me thinking more philosophically about animal issues, and you know, continued to do a lot of reading in animal ethics and was weighing going to grad school in philosophy and getting a PhD and continuing to focus on animal ethics versus going to law school and getting a JD. And I thought that maybe I could do a little more good, practically speaking, or change more animals' lives if I went to law school rather than grad school. So I went to law school knowing that I wanted to do animal law and made some connections with folks at the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And after I graduated, did a clerkship with a judge for a year and then came straight here and been here for almost 8 years.
Wow. Well, it's wonderful that you're there and that they have you and that you're able to do this great work. Thank you for that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very lucky to be doing the work that I'm doing. It's gratifying and I think makes a difference.
There's a lot of work to be done, unfortunately.
That's true, for sure.
And I wish we had more attorneys that were interested in fighting the fight for the right and for the voiceless rather than making a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, people, there's lots of ways for people to support us. People who are already lawyers can sign up to be part of our pro bono work if they want to help contribute to some cases. And even people who aren't lawyers can sign up for our action alerts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter and come to our website and find out what people can do to help animals.
Now, it's been a week since this ag-gag law in Idaho has been declared unconstitutional. What's the response been since that time?
Overwhelmingly positive. In fact, I just got an email today from someone who teaches at the University of Idaho's agriculture program thanking us for bringing the lawsuit and congratulating us on our win. And, yeah, I mean, almost everyone I talked to has been surprised that such a thing could pass and relieved that the courts were willing to strike it down.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I want to have faith in the justice system, and I want to believe that good will prevail, but so much has happened where it's just so frustrating. But, you know, occasionally something wonderful happens, and I want to think that we're slowly but surely moving in a very, very positive direction.
I think that's right. I mean, the legal system has usually lags behind a little bit. It's, I think, by nature a conservative institution, just because so much is based on precedent and what's happened before and what the law is rather than what it should be. But I think with there are cases where we can make progress, and I think this is one of them.
So do you have any long-term plans? Do you see yourself on the Supreme Court? Do you think we'll get some animal-friendly lawyers on the Supreme Court one day?
I'd like to think one day. I know that I would never make it through the confirmation process, so I don't have any judicial aspirations myself. But I've known some really, really amazing judges. I clerked before I came to ALDF, and the judge I clerked for, who has sadly passed away, was, you know, when I was working for him, an 83-year-old white guy, but he got these issues. He was incredibly compassionate and progressive, and I think if had the right animal case come before him, you know, he would give it a fair shot and strive to do justice. And I think, you know, those judges are not especially common, but they're out there. I know of at least one vegan judge, and you know, this decision in Idaho shows that even judges in places that we might think of as conservative are willing to do the right thing and honor the Constitution when the case comes before them.
Okay, I have one more question. When you're working really hard on a case, what are you eating?
Well, I'm a vegan myself. You know, the first rule of legal ethics is don't eat your clients. So I'm generally a pretty healthy eater. So today it's brown rice and tempeh and chard.
Nice. Excellent. I'm really glad to hear that. And that's probably what gives you a lot of energy and clarity. I just remember recently that during a lot of governmental meetings. I think it was when they were trying to figure out how to deal with this Iran nuclear policy stuff. Somebody documented what everybody was eating, and it was a disaster, all kinds of candy and junk food. And I mean, you just can't do anything right when you're eating like that.
Yeah, I will say that they just, not far from our office, opened up a vegan fast food restaurant, Amy's Drive-Thru. And so I had a burger and fries and a vegan milkshake that were actually pretty good.
Nice, that sounds good. Well, it can't be, it's got to be a lot better than the animal variety.
Yes, that's
correct. Okay, well, I don't hear my theme song. I hear the Mr. Softy theme song outside. but that's a good time to say thank you very much for joining me on It's All About Food, and keep up the great, great work.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, thanks, Matthew. All right, let's take a little break while the Mr. Softy truck is going around my neighborhood. I'm not promoting Mr. Softy. He's just always here. All right, we'll take a little break, and then we're going to be back with Robin Lamont. I'm really looking forward to speaking with her about her new book, The Trap.